Good morning again. We'll begin as people come in. Perhaps just the first matter of business that David wanted me to clear up. For those of you who aren't familiar with this center, the washrooms are out to the entranceway and to the left and through the doors, and that's into the gym area, and you'll find them left and right according to your the particular symbol on the door. My name is David Ridley. I'm here to introduce the presenter this morning for this session titled Mohandas Gandhi, Satyagraha, and the Living Out of Peace. Is that not bad? Did I get that? I also, according to local custom, tried to introduce a little bit of a Norwegian inflection into that. And I also wrote out this morning with one of Hannah's colleagues in Hindi class, Helen Arnett, so I was able to scope that out. It's my delight to introduce Hannah. You can see from the write-up on, as a presenter, her work in peace studies and her interest and her lived, embodied, present interest to the Gandhian philosophy and her connection with the Gandhi Foundation. And then also her work in Edmonton's inner city and with the Bissell Center. She just recently returned to the University of Alberta with her studies in the Department of Human Ecology, which is in the Faculty of Home Ec and Forestry and Agriculture. Yeah, well, let's not go into that. And also something that it's to provide something that isn't here, she's also... I would consider you a fellow of the Salmon Arm Bluegrass Workshop, a violinist, fiddler, and so she's also active with that. And also, you know, the new aunt of twins, your sister, of course. So this is all sort of family stuff that I have some knowledge of. So we're delighted to have you here. And we will, of course... with the time that you have, an hour or so, and then we'll have some time to speak afterwards. So, Hannah, welcome. Good to have you here.
My interest in bluegrass music is deeply rooted in peace studies and everything. We can discuss it later, maybe more personally. Gandhi, I'm not sure if he ever listened to bluegrass, but I'm sure... If he listened to those lyrics, he would have been horrified. But the process of making the music is pretty incredible. I haven't done a lot of this. I'll be a little bit shaky. But, yeah, I'll talk a bit, and then we'll have a lot of time to discuss and bring up different points about it. So I'm going to start with just a little quote from Dorothy Day. Jim was talking about her last night from The Catholic Worker, and it will come up a couple times. It's another... she's another person I'm really quite interested in and have spent a little bit of time in Catholic worker houses in Toronto when I've had the opportunity. And the theme that we heard about this morning as well, love and ever more love is the only solution to every problem that comes up. So the birth of Satyagraha was September 11th, interestingly enough, 1906. And in Gandhi's own words, describing the birth of the movement, he says, "None of us knew what name to give to our movement. I then used the term passive resistance in describing it. I did not quite understand the implications of passive resistance as I called it. I only knew that some new principle had come into being. As the struggle advanced, the phrase passive resistance gave rise to confusion, and it appeared shameful to permit this great struggle to be known only by an English name." Again, that foreign phrase could hardly pass as current coin among the community. A small prize was therefore announced in Indian Opinion, the publication, the newspaper that he was editor of, to be awarded to the reader who invented the best designation for our struggle. We thus received a number of suggestions. The meaning of the struggle had been then fully discussed in Indian Opinion, and the competitors for the prize had fairly sufficient material to serve as a basis for their exploration. Sri Maganlal Gandhi was one of the competitors, and he suggested the word satyagraha, meaning firmness in a good cause. I liked the word, but it did not fully represent the whole idea I wished it to connote. I therefore corrected it to satyagraha. Truth, satya, implies love, and firmness, agraha, engenders and therefore serves as a synonym for force. I thus began to call the Indian movement satyagraha, that is to say, the force which is born of truth and love, or nonviolence, and gave up the use of the phrase passive resistance in connection with it. So much so that even in English writing, we often avoided it and used instead the word satyagraha itself or some other equivalent English phrase. This then was the genesis of the movement which came to be known as satyagraha and of the word used as its designation for it. So this was coined while he was in South Africa working for rights of Indians under the system of apartheid. And then when he returned to India, it was further developed and implemented in the freedom struggle there. So satyagraha is more a movement, a way of being, of acting in this world, than it is a principle or ideology. Truth, love, and nonviolence are fundamental elements to Gandhi's description of satyagraha. And as we know, truth and love cannot be pinned down, but are dynamic, ever-moving virtues. The nonviolence that is born of this search for truth and out of love is also not static, but dynamic. Nonviolence, as expressed in satyagraha, is not a technique employed to achieve one's ends, but a spiritual practice. Gandhi was born to a devout Jain mother. The principle of ahimsa, which means the non-injury to living beings, is found in Hinduism and Buddhism, but is most defining of Jainism. In the Jain religion, the living out of ahimsa is actively practiced. What one eats, when one eats, what one wears are all determined by the principle of nonviolence. So Gandhi grew up in this environment where everything that he did was governed by, like, was seen through the lens of harm to others or non-harm, non-injury to other sentient beings. And the point of, like, Jains will often not eat root vegetables even, because to eat a root is to pull up the whole plant. So it can go quite far in terms of its respect for life. So the concept of ahimsa rests on the conviction that all life is connected, and therefore harm to one is harm to all. Now Gandhi took this practice of ahimsa from the level of individual relationships with sentient beings to a structural level. His practice of ahimsa included the personal, but extended to the social, political, and economic realms as well. So this concept of what I kind of call structural ahimsa is sort of articulated in an excerpt from a CD I have, Utah Phillips. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he spent a number of years in a Catholic worker house in Salt Lake City with Ammon Hennessy, who was a very active Catholic worker and quite an interesting and incredible character. And so one day Ammon was talking to Utah, and so this is in Utah's words recounting the encounter. He said, "You've got to be a pacifist." I said, "Why?" "It'll save your life." And apparently Utah's behavior was very violent at that point. He'd come back from the Korean War quite angry and acting out in many violent ways. And so Utah asked, "Well, what is it?" And Ammon responds, "Well, I can't give you a book by Gandhi, because you wouldn't understand it. I can't give you a list of rules that if you sign it, you're a pacifist." He said, "You look at it like booze. You know alcoholism will kill somebody until they finally get the courage to sit in a circle of people like that and put their hand up in the air and say, 'Hi, my name is Utah. I'm an alcoholic.' And then you can begin to deal with the behavior and have the people define it for you whose lives you've destroyed." He said, "It's the same with violence. An alcoholic, they could be dry for 20 years. They're never going to sit in that circle and put their hand up and say, 'I'm not an alcoholic anymore.' No, they're still going to put their hand up and say, 'Hi, my name is Utah. I'm an alcoholic.' So it's the same with violence. You've got to be able to put your hand in the air and acknowledge the capacity for violence and then deal with the behavior and have the people whose lives you've messed with define that behavior for you. And it's not going to go away. You're going to be dealing with it in every moment, in every situation, for the rest of your life. I said, okay, I'll try that. And Ammon said, it's not enough. You were born a white man in mid-20th century industrial America. You came into the world armed to the teeth with an arsenal of weapons, the weapons of privilege, racial privilege, sexual privilege, economic privilege. You want to be a pacifist. It's not just giving up guns and knives and clubs and fists and angry words, but giving up the weapons of privilege and going into the world completely disarmed. Try that. So I've always really liked this little description of pacifism. It's always left me a little bit uncomfortable, though, and I sort of have been thinking about it the last few days and figured out why. And I guess it's that it's defined in negation. It's sort of what you don't do to be a pacifist. Satyagraha is firmly grounded in, I would say, this type of pacifism and in recognizing the implications of your actions in every sphere. But it's also, however, deeply committed to action. Non-injury is not sufficient. Engagement in this world, action to effect change in this world, is necessary. The form this action takes, however, requires faith. Gandhi was adamant that the ends never justify the means. The ends are never in our hands. We cannot manipulate what will happen. We have no control over the outcome of events. All we have are the means that we employ, the day-to-day of relating to each other. To achieve a peaceful world, it is essential that this day-to-day relating is nonviolent, because that's all we have. It's the world that we're creating. So the temptation to control outcomes, however, is great and requires a great amount of faith to overcome. To try to manipulate an end is to live out of fear, to not trust the workings of God in our lives, and to try to determine for ourselves what will be. So to act is to set something in motion without attachment to what it might achieve. To act is to live in faith. So Hannah Arendt, another favorite of mine, who happens to be in part who I was named after, she distinguishes between making and action. She talks about how making is what one does when you follow a recipe. So you have a picture of the end in mind, and you take specific steps to achieve it. For baking muffins, this is very useful. In creating a world, though, and in building relationships, it can be detrimental. And I think this is something that we've really moved towards in the modern world, is this idea of making our world. Institutions are set up to manage risk, not to have people come together and create something new. And so Arendt talks about how it's through action and words, through words and deeds, that we insert ourselves into the human world. And she talks about how action is boundless and unpredictable. She says, to act, in its most general sense, means to take an initiative, to begin, to set something into motion. The new always happens against the overwhelming odds of statistical laws and their probability, which for all practical, everyday purposes amounts to certainty. The new, therefore, always appears in the guise of a miracle. The fact that man is capable of action means that the unexpected can be expected from him, that he is able to perform what is infinitely improbable. This is terrifying for our bureaucratic structures to contemplate, and terrifying for most of us as well. Fabrication is much more comfortable. Technology and management are sort of the foundations of our current institutions, and it's through this that we have certainty in our lives. We know what's going to happen, which is important in some aspects. It's important, you know, like if you need to catch a plane, to know that it's going to be flying that day. However, this has been transposed into the public sphere, into the public discourse, where that has been taken away from us, or we've willingly given it up for this security. And so long before 9/11, long before any form of terrorist attacks, we have given up this space in which we can act as human beings together and create our world. And it's no surprise that once you give that up, there's room for all kinds of terror to come in, from government sources, from you know, non-governmental factions. It's not, yeah, it shouldn't surprise us that much. So when I talk of action, I'm not referring to John Wayne, as Jim was talking about last night, but to the Samaritan, who is drawn not out of ideology or social norms, but despite them, is drawn to come into relationship with a stranger. This type of action has no design and has no predetermined end. It simply is what it is. Through this satyagraha, dialogue is opened. As Vandana Shiva says, spaces of freedom are created in spaces of unfreedom. That which narrows the possibility of dialogue, which shuts down relationships, cannot be satyagraha. Satyagraha, as nonviolent action, is not refraining from hitting someone, but acting on something that grows from within. Satyagraha is not John Wayne, here to rescue us, but is people together creating a world. Fear, however, narrows these spaces and possibilities of dialogue and shuts down relationships. Fear works to control and manipulate instead of letting relationships breathe and unfold. Because of fear, we continue to harm one another, and we don't act in the boundless and unpredictable ways Arendt describes. We do not act as anarchists, able to govern ourselves, but instead we continue in the fabrication of a world that is unsustainable and harmful to all. This violence polarizes and relates people in the only way that it can, as enemies instead of co-creators of a world. We can see this fear all around us, and how so much of what we do separates us from other people. So many technologies which all come in, you know, for safety and for security, and it's very difficult to say no to them, to a cell phone if you're driving long distances in darkness or in snow can save your life, right? But cell phones also mean that the people you're sitting with at the table are not the ones that you're speaking with. And the world we're creating just time and time again separates us from each other, and is focused more on management of details and much less on engaging each other as human beings. And so satyagraha is not interested in overcoming one's enemies, but in coming into relationship with them. And so Merton talks of this, of course. I think that's... I'll kind of close with this and we can then have some good discussion. So if we really sought truth, we would begin slowly and laboriously to divest ourselves one by one of all our coverings of fiction and delusion. Or at least we would desire to do so. For mere willing cannot enable us to effect it. On the contrary, the one who can best point out our error and help us to see it is the adversary whom we wish to destroy. This is perhaps why we wish to destroy him. So too, we can help him to see his error, and that is why he wants to destroy us. In the long run, no one can show another the error that is within him, unless the other is convinced that his critic first sees and loves the good that is within him. So while we are perfectly willing to tell our adversary he is wrong, we will never be able to do so effectively until we can ourselves appreciate where he is right. And we can never accept his judgment on our errors until he gives evidence that he really appreciates our own peculiar truth. Love, love only, love of our deluded fellow man as he actually is, in his delusion and in his sin. This alone can open the door to truth. As long as we do not have this love, as long as this love is not active and effective in our lives, for words and good wishes will never suffice, we have no real access to the truth, at least not to moral truth. So I'm going to leave things about here, and we can talk about this stuff. And I didn't talk a lot about Gandhi, and so I realized a few days ago talking to a friend, like, what are you going to talk about? I'm like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And says, oh, well, what's this? And I'm like, oh, I guess not everybody knows, you know, the story of the independence movement in India. So we can, if people are interested in that, we can talk a bit about that, or we can, yeah. just have some discussion if that's...
Thank you.
Good.
Your remarks, and yes, lots to step into from there. That exchange between Phillips, or Utah Phillips and Henderson, so touch point amongst many others. Anyone from the here would like to pick up on what Hannah has brought to us and explore that a bit more?
I was struck by the word accuser and her adversary in that last bit that you were reading, because, I mean, the Christian tradition and the readings for this week come from Job, and Satan in the Hebrew was often described as the accuser or the adversary.
Mm-hmm.
So to see the adversary within ourselves, you know, is to, you know, the need to look at our dark side and to then see what we are capable of doing, you know, where we could actually kill somebody or the evil that we can do on ourselves and how it can shape us. And then in my own experience, when a bully attacked me when I was in grade 11, I was able to put him in a chokehold. And when he started to turn blue and gasp, I said, if you ever touch me again, I won't let go next time. And that was, you know, like the realization that I could actually do that.
Yeah. I really like that, bringing up of Job and the root of the word Satan is the adversary, is the accuser. It is not an evil entity. It is someone who challenges. And I think that is really what Gandhi talks about. He was adamant that the British had no power except that the Indians gave it to them. And so it's the sort of giving up of oneself and recognizing how you can lose your own humanity or your own ability to be good and to do good in this world that creates these situations.
Would you be willing to come up and teach us that chokehold, though?
Just in case. All this, you know.
I was raised in a family of 8 children, and I had an older and a younger brother, and we spent a lot of time wrestling and boxing and fighting. So.
I won't even confess my confession. You bring it up later. Helen?
Thank you.
Yeah, just expanding on this gentleman's example, which I think is a very good personal one, I'm struggling with applying Gandhiji's concept of satyagraha to the leader of the North Korean country. How do we look at truth, love, and nonviolence? I'm not really expecting you to answer this.
I'm glad you asked.
I feel like this gentleman wanting to put that guy in a what do you call it?
Chokehold.
But then, where is this principle of satyagraha in all that?
I see that as he has lived his life being attacked from the outside. Like he's been surrounded, put down, he's been bullied all his life. And so he's only acting out the bully, what he knows, because that's the bullies have beaten him so often. You know, he's now standing up. And that's his response to how he's been treated by the Western cultures and all cultures. Like the Koreans have been oppressed many times in their past. And Jimmy Carter wrote in the New York Times on the 11th about why they find themselves in this situation today is the distrust that he has, because there was agreements signed between Korea and the United States around nuclear atomic plants and fuel and food that went in 2002 that were eliminated when the people in power in Washington came in. And this is, he just has no trust of following the rules. So that's, you know, kind of a...
I suppose that so many of the actions that are taken from the West are calculated to do something, but actually what they end up doing is create far more mistrust and make other cultures feel like they're under siege. I can see the Muslim point of view very clearly, where it's obvious that there is a pogrom against Islam, no matter what kind of rhetoric is used. And essentially, from their point of view, we want to force on them Western culture, which is, of course, pornography and alcohol, drugs, and sexual abuse, and all these other things that are so vibrant in our culture. And to continue to put that kind of pressure is, you know, fear, all anger comes from fear. There's no other source of anger except fear. So when you put somebody in the corner and they start with fear, then it goes to anger, and anger matures into hatred. And consequently, every time you force people into a corner, you have to generate anger and you have to generate revenge. And if somebody's in a position where we're so much more powerful than they are, consequently terrorism is the only possible resort they have, then we have to look at to the degree to which we're generating terrorism ourselves, or at least the United States as a superpower is actually making terrorism an absolute inevitability by refusing to take into account the way the other culture receives what we're doing. And with absolutely no intention whatsoever of trying to understand it. We have absolute non-negotiables. We're going to bomb you into democracy. And we're going to destroy as much of your culture and your religion as is necessary in order to make you like us, so that we won't have to be afraid of you anymore. Mm-hmm. And whether or not anybody's sitting calculating that in Washington, D.C., I'm sure people are sitting calculating that in Tehran and other places, because that's precisely what it would appear to be from the other point of view.
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, it's hard to, I think you're both talking a lot about how we engender this sort of behavior and how we can so easily, how we create our enemies. They don't come from nowhere. We definitely create them through our actions and through our, through our behavior towards them. And then what you do once that's created is a very difficult question, because you need to, in some ways, then everything that hasn't been done up until then, all the trust, all of the love that hasn't been shown, you need to exponentially to gain back that trust, and it's hard to do. It's very difficult to do in a bureaucracy.
It has some validity, instead of just propagandizing against their point of view to present their point of view as if it had some validity and some basis.
Mm-hmm.
Would help a great deal.
Yeah.
Brenda, do you have a...
Yes. Given the situation which we just heard, we know that we want to achieve peace. We got the situation effect. How do we apply the principles of Satyagraha to solve that problem? I mean, we have a strong weapon, we call. We believe that Satyagraha is a very strong weapon, and it won at one time. Let's apply the same principle in the situation we face back. How do you do that?
that's a good question.
That's an open question.
That's an open question. Do you?
Well, something about Gandhiji's phrase, the personal is political, so that by 1947, he himself was able, in the time of the intense violence, was able to say, I myself will not eat until there is peace in the land, broadly. And that was actually able to work. I mean, by that point, he had such moral currency that one human being's decision to face death himself was actually able to galvanize the whole situation. I mean, that to me seems sort of incredible that it actually did work. the massacre in Punjab, the responses after that, you know, were sort of various, but one human being's response was enough, at least for a moment in time, to galvanize the situation so that they could make steps forward. So, like, I mean, that's maybe one.
Well, this is what I'm saying, that we should be able to apply that principle. Mm-hmm. Let's all 200 million people go on the thing and not eat Friday. Will we solve that problem?
No, and I think that it's, Gandhi says that if there is one true Satyagrahi in India, the British could not rule. Because the British could rule because Indians would let them. And it's the same in our circumstance. We're able to have everything go on because we allow it to happen. And it's so difficult to know how to stand up for a truth or what that truth might be. But that sort of non-cooperation in what generates this kind of violence is...
I think Hannah gave us the key.
Can I just...
to that, because she commented about the relationships between people, the personal relationships. During that period of time when Gandhiji was fasting and he thought he was dying at the very end, didn't he call in a Muslim, a Christian, a Hindu to say prayers over his dying body? And didn't that scene get transferred to all of Pakistan, all of India, like it was more than just, it works. I mean, those are simple, easy words to say, it works. But when we think about the details of how it worked, it's through the key that you spoke about, Hannah. Relationships.
There was a couple comments in the back, and then Don or Krista, were you into it? And is there another? Sorry, is there someone else?
Can I say something quickly? Sorry, David. quickly. I'm going to forget what it was. In terms of, Vrinder, what you were saying about if, you know, 200 million people fasted for a day, would that work? And I think that's where Satyagraha gets mistaken as a technique, and it's still working towards an end and manipulating some kind of end. And that is what, like, I've spent a lot of time in the activist community in Edmonton, and it's often very frustrating because it's completely driven towards achieving, to manipulating the future, and it's not grounded in faith. It's not grounded in what I do today I am doing because it is how I can live peace in my life. Whether that is not eating potatoes or whether that is not, you know, like paying taxes. I know people, members of the Catholic Worker in Toronto, intentionally do not make above a certain amount of money a year because they refuse to pay taxes to have their money going to weaponization and the military and that sort of thing. So recognizing where violence exists in our lives and how we contribute to it, and then out of faith saying no is very difficult.
Yeah, one thing, sorry. If what happened was that basically it was the intention on Gandhi's part, the immense intention that I want to get rid of this yoke and care. That immense intention is what we need today to face whatever is happening to us. We are lacking that immense intention that Gandhi had. He used Satyagraha, he used many other things too, but the most important thing what he used was the strong intention. We don't have that. He was ready to sacrifice everything, even his life, to fight that. How many people in North America and the Western world are willing to do that?
Yeah.
To root out the terror of any kind. that is the terror of individuals, terror of governments, terror of one's community over the other. There are lots of terror happening. We have to have the intention, and we have to be willing to give everything for it. That's
it. I realized a few months ago I was feeling afraid of war and afraid of what I saw Gone with the Wind, and that image of what's her name?
Scarlett O'Hara.
The image of Scarlett O'Hara out in the field. I will never be hungry again. And just that, you know, like scraping ground, looking for anything to eat. And I realize I'm afraid of that. And I think that we don't have that intention because we can't let go of the fear of having nothing, of not having all of the benefits that come to us from the existing status quo. And it's in relationship that you realize that's where wealth lies. Wealth does not lie in these things that we have for ourselves, but in other people, in our relationship with other people. I'm starting my master's as it's in Loretta, and we have this whole class on, I'm doing a course on poverty, and we're talking about how you measure poverty and how difficult it is, because someone, like, I think it would be almost impossible for me to fall into poverty. I could have nothing. And I know, like, I see half a dozen people in this room who would provide anything and everything I would need in that time, whereas someone else could be making... You know, there are people living in Silicon Valley making tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars who can't afford a house. And without those connections, it's hard because it's scary. This world is a big place all by yourself. Krista, yeah.
I hope it's still sort of relevant, but I like that you're saying that you've been working and that's the following the recipe, right? And then there's also the creating. So the making is sort of the mean, like looking at the end and trying to manipulate that in. So I'm just thinking about it in my mind right now, like from a smaller scale to a larger scale. And the bigger countries that are in power treating some of the ways to resolve some of the issues that we have nowadays sort of as a kind of almost in a recipe type of manner. And as though, like, sort of, if we do this, we'll have this end, rather than sort of giving a gift to maybe a country that's more impoverished than us, to give them some freedom to allow that other country to have the chance to create. Because instead, we sort of imply that if we do this, you guys must do this, and this will create this. And so it's... And then it doesn't go that way, and then that's where conflict arises. And I also like what you're saying about the satyagraha with the loving our enemies. You didn't quite say loving our enemies, but
yeah, you know,
that's similar exactly. Idea where things that bother us in ourselves often are because, like, things that bother us that someone else has pointed out about us is that one of those things that we maybe need to work on. And in order to have our enemies open up to us and like to be able to help our enemies, and for vice versa, for there to be an exchange there has to be love first and trust. And but if we're, anyways, I'm getting to the end here now. So with the making, when you start off you're making in order to have an end, and you're not allowing for that freedom of healing to occur, like, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be any type of action which is to create. Whereas I see just the example, the Korea example, you know, where who knows the exact situation, but that person might be feeling so distrustful that they themselves can't create anything new. They just have to have their structure.
Yeah.
To open up discussions.
And that, yeah, it goes back to different understandings of Satan, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Satan has... as an evil entity that polarizes and you need to defeat, and there's no room for coming together. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, that Merton even talks about how in that, if you have that view of your enemy, then to engage your enemy is to pollute your own idea of truth. It's to pollute your own understanding of the world, and you will lose what little is left in the world to engage the enemy. But if you see your enemy as an adversary, as someone who challenges you, who questions your actions, and you're able to question their actions, but love them and see where they're also where they are right, then you can open up dialogue and you can come into a relationship and like Hannah Arendt says, it's unpredictable and it's boundless. You know, like it just, and I love how she talks about like in that way, whenever there's something new, it always comes in the guise of a miracle. And we see it as a miracle, but it's just something new.
And if there's no room for that, then that's the static. Whereas you said the satyagrana is supposed to be dynamic. It's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Don. Certainly enjoying what you're saying about this. I think it's so important, and I'm very glad you have introduced this to us. Going back to the comment about Gandhi fasting. Gandhi was fasting in a culture that respected and understood fasting.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that we live in a very different culture. I think people fasting in Canada would not have anything like the same resonance. So it's a question of admiring. Well, Gerard Manley Hopkins said, the essence of art is to admire and then do differently. So we can admire what Gandhi did at that moment and then use our imaginations in the present to see what would be a similar symbol, which brings me to your point about not being fixated on results, as Jim was reminding us about last night. I think we can go too far in that direction, in that Gandhi certainly had a view of satyagraha, but he also developed strategies. So it's not that we don't develop strategies, it's that we don't put our trust in the strategies. Gandhi tried many different campaigns, and some of them worked and some of them didn't. But because he was not fixated on them in terms of results, he was not in despair until the very end, I have to say. But for most of his career, he did come out of that despair. The problem about fixating on the results is when you don't get the results that your clever plan you thought would bring, then you sink into despair. But if you are seeking truth in yourself, then you have a foundation that doesn't insulate you from despair, but it enables you to resist the temptation to despair. And my increasing sense is in this very atomized individualistic society, is that we have to find what I call intermediate communities. That is to say, communities between ourselves as an individual and the state, in which we can, as you've been saying, challenge each other in a loving way. Work at being satyagrahis in company with other people who are working at the same thing. A big revelation that I had about Gandhi, it was right there on the page, I just hadn't noticed it before, was when I read his book, Hind Swaraj. Have you read that, that book? About self-rule for India, published in 1909. And his essential point in that book is, India will not be ready for self-rule, Swaraj, until we have achieved self-rule in ourselves. And self-rule in ourselves means dealing with all these violences and so on. So if we could develop a network of, now I'm talking strategy, and if I place my trust in it and it fails, I'll fall into despair, right? So I'm just offering it and letting it go at the same time. But it does pick up on what you were saying, I think, about a place in our lives where we can work on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, sir.
I was really struck by the phrase that you mentioned. I think it's Hannah Arendt. To try to manipulate an end is to live in fear. Use that phrase.
Yeah.
I'm really struck by that. And I think that's short. Well, okay. I think that's a remarkable insight. And I'm going to take it in a couple of ways. I think right now a lot of us Canadians are in mourning that we see ourselves collectively being manipulated into living in that fear, and that some of what we might have seen as a kind of good intention in the world over the last 30, 40 years in terms of seeing ourselves as peacekeepers has been abandoned, and we are part of another war machine, in a sense, in Afghanistan. And it is being fueled by this constant manipulation to live in fear. And on the other side of it, so we are trying to control an end. And I think the comment here about the control an end is make those people like us, therefore decent human beings. And anything other than us can't be quite that. Which goes back to what Jim Forrest was saying last night about it's our fear of the other, and because the other is different, and wanting to eliminate that difference, not by any change in us, but by changing the other. And then the other thing that strikes me is then, what do we do? And I would like to get back to a Canada that I was more proud of than I am right now. And that's not to cast any aspersions on the individuals who were over there risking their lives and dying, but it's to say what we've become, which has changed a lot. And a couple of things. I like what Don just said now, because he says strategy is fine. Just don't trust that the strategy will work. And then the other thing Don just said is, I did some number counting there. I think, okay, Gandhi wrote that in 1909. It happened in 1948. You know, so it took a while. And I think we would like these things to happen 10 days from now, you know.
Yesterday.
If it takes that long, yeah. So then, and I think your other suggestion is it's somehow to live in this peace, to live in this truth and love on an individual basis and trust that that's how it happens. And it happens through dialogue. It happens, actually, this kind of thing we're doing today. And it's so strange that in the world, this what we are doing is labeled as naive and foolish, and not knowing reality. Yeah. And yet, the opposite is naive and foolish and not knowing reality. Mm-hmm. War does not bring about peace.
Just have another moment. Everyone, thanks for the succinctness of your remarks, but there's others speaking, so we'll just proceed. Yes. And then
I was listening so much that I to get back from my reading or understanding, part of Gandhi's despair after independence was again the resumption of Hinduism tensions and the dispersion to Pakistan and dividing again on religious lines. And what blocks my ability to live in peace is to see the control of systemic religious terrorism or organization. As soon as we achieve an end, it's going to go back to the way it was. We're going to go at each other again. And some of this, again, I find hard to live in peace with the moral outrage of many of the systemic terrorism activities against women in major religions. I mean, you hear about what the Taliban has done is, of course, the obvious example. But in all our religions, we have systemic terrorism against women in terms of, you know, hate. No, I shouldn't. I'm apologizing for discussing women's rights, and I shouldn't do that.
Don't apologize.
So,
just don't expect any funding for it.
Not yet. When we look at how to live in peace, it's so basic, and I guess part of it is what I'm saying. It's our relationships, even between men and women, and men and children, and women and children, and looking at the other in terms of our gender has it's always been in the, since the organized religious times, if you read in the Bible, the Quran. So how do you change the world? And again, you're not going to answer this. To start looking at such basic principles when we are so deep into systemic otherness, right in the very basic level. Like, it's, so it's hard for me to live in peace when I feel moral outrage.
Yeah. And that's, I was in India about a year ago on a course with Satish Kumar, actually. And I don't know, exciting, hey? And
that's
Vandana
okay.
Shiva.
I heard Utah Phillips at the Vancouver Folk Festival.
You work with my guru, I'll work
with you. That's right. It was really frustrating. I think you sort of addressed in terms of talking about intermediary relationships and how it is systemic and it's so nebulous. And I, you know, like I often, I don't know if I pray for an adversary that I can see, but the way that we've set things up, it's so difficult to put your hand on, to put your finger on what it is that you can do to change because you need a driver's license to drive, and so it's you know, like buying into that part of the bureaucratic system, da da da. It's really, really difficult. And what ended up happening on this course I was on, I was endlessly frustrated because it kept going back to, well, grow a garden. And I'm like, okay, I love growing a garden. I love shopping at the farmer's market. All of those like local, those relationships in my community are absolutely essential. And I won't, you know, like, absolutely essential. But then, like, how do you connect that to what's happening globally? And I think that's why I went back to school, because I don't know. And I'm really interested in figuring that out, because it isn't enough to grow a garden. You might not be Scarlett O'Hara if you have a garden, but living in Edmonton in January, you still would be. And so we still need to look at these structural systemic things and the idea of intermediary relationships, I think, is really important. And the idea of patience, that we can't, like, it's been centuries, you know, like, this, it's been building, and the way that we live our lives in the modern world didn't happen overnight, and the way that to change it isn't going to happen overnight either.
We have a number of people wanting to make comments, so I think Della and Vidita, and please.
Some of the best advice I got about writing was that if you like a sentence a lot, you might want to look at it and maybe extract it from your writing. Because obviously, if you have this real love affair with this sentence, it could be that that's where your problem is. And very often, what happens when you pray for an adversary, I mean, what we need is to find out what it is in the way we live, in the systems that support our style of life, that we fear the most losing. And when we look at the root of our defensiveness, then we have to disarm. Whether getting rid of defense on a personal level is the only way that we can probably start working on national defense, getting rid of that particular approach to all of our problems. Because any time a nation becomes defensive is when that's how we generate wars. And so I guess I'm just trying to articulate what I hear about this adversary. The usefulness of the adversary is in locating where our defensiveness is and then trying to root that out and see what it is we're protecting, what it is we care the most about not giving up, and where it is we need to lay down our lives.
Ladika, did you have a
just an observation to think about why we can be manipulated into fear for our security so easily and be so indifferent to the fact that the whole ecosystem around us is collapsing so that our grandchildren won't have anything to eat. And we don't seem to be afraid of that. What we're afraid of is losing our second car and the gas price is going too high. But we're not afraid of what's real, that that needs to be dealt with, because we're so malleable that we can be manipulated into fearing what I dare say some oligarchy wants us to fear, and ignoring the things that should truly be feared, which affect all humanity instead of just us and our privilege. That's just a thought.
Thank you.
Sir. Well,
Gandhi,
I mean, he worked with the National Independence Party in India to help bring independence with Nehru, and he didn't shy away from formal politics in that sense. So what do you see as the role then of Satyagraha and formal party politics in bringing about an imperfect good? Because there tends to be amongst an anarchist type of cynicism of formal politics, and yet parties are the fairies that take us from one shoreline to the other, always imperfectly. And you're always throwing stones at them. You get in a bad cycle of protesting and protesting, and nothing gets done. So when you're asking the bigger questions beyond growing the garden, and you want to deal with big issues of war and peace, crime and punishment, you know, poverty and all, what is the role, the good role, albeit imperfect role, of formal party politics in Canada and elsewhere in bringing about an imperfect good on the stage of world politics? I ask that because I teach political science, and my practical questions is because I see a lot of people as protest or advocacy politics, and they have their role to play, but they're not the big fairies that move you across the waters of time and bring changes. And if you have cynicism in regards to parties, then you doom yourself to constant protest and never participating in the transformations on the stage of world politics. That, say, Gandhi, even he had anarchist tendencies, but he worked with Nehru and Gore and all the big people in the independence movement. So any thoughts on Satyagraha, formal party politics?
I think one of the things that really struck me in India was the capacity for dialogue. That there was so much, you know, you would meet someone, and within a few minutes, not everybody, but not, like, more than once, so what do you believe? What do you believe? Where are you going? Like, what is the purpose of your life? And it catches you a little off guard, because, you know, you've met this person, like, 2 minutes ago. But I think that we've lost that capacity to talk about things on that level, and we don't at all, and it's really evident in the political sphere. And I think that that's one of the first things that needs to happen, is that in those spheres, in the public sphere that we've so willingly given up, we need to take it back, and we need to bring in these conversations and discussions and have more than sound bites and more than like real ideas would be a nice thing in party politics. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right that it needs to be engaged in that. With my peers, we talk about it a lot, like whether, you know, going out to the forest, but it doesn't carry you across. You need to engage, and how to engage with love and without getting tarnished by the adversary is challenging. I don't know if other people have thoughts on that, because it's not.
I think you have to be an activist to be passive, and I think Gandhi would agree with that. One of the phrases that is part of his vocabulary and certainly became part of Martin Luther King's and others that I don't think we hear much about, and I'd be interested in you commenting on this, is the concept of non-cooperation. One of the ways that I can deal with the evil around me is just not cooperate with it. But more often than not, as long as it doesn't touch me, as long as it doesn't touch my family, as long as it doesn't impact my income, it's different strokes for different folks, and you let it go. And so you use the illustration of alcoholism. I think in many ways we become enablers of the evil around us simply because we cooperate in not doing anything. And I think that, you know, that non-cooperation was not passive, it was active. And I think that's part of the party politics that Gandhi had, was that he was willing to say, you know, where am I going to be able to place my demonstration of my non-cooperation with the things that I don't agree with? But I think that in our day and age, passivism means I'll sit by and do nothing.
Yeah.
Being passive in that sense certainly is not what Gandhi had in mind, nor do I think it's the solution to the problems that we face. But I think non-cooperation is a concept that we need in our day and age to revisit, because one of the most active things that we can do is simply refuse to cooperate with the evils around us.
Yeah. And I think that I'm glad you brought it up, because it's a very central part of Satyagraha. And one of another thing that Gandhi said a lot about was talked about the emancipation of the mind. And Steve Biko said, you know, the greatest weapon of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And so I think the first place to not cooperate is to not be afraid the way we're being told to be afraid, and to still engage and talk to our neighbor and talk to Muslims in our community, talk to other people who on the surface seem to be different and who may be different in many ways, and then taking that to the next level. I'm not as clear on how to do that.
And
but
it's also not the same. I mean, in terms of strategy, the ways in which I find that I can be non-cooperative are not going to be the same that somebody else is going to find.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not do what I do, it's do what will work for you to be non-cooperative. And I think instead of trying to create sort of a universal strategy of techniques, what you end up with is a group of people who all agree that in whatever way works for me, I'm going to be non-cooperative with the evils around me. And I think that then becomes a movement.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Desmond Dollarwood made a comment a few minutes ago about art and seeing art in a different way. What strikes me in the conference last night and this morning are the links since the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and that those gardens have been growing for half a decade. And I'm sensing sort of winds of hope in listening and hearing the commentary today that there are really gardens and fairies all around us. And maybe one of the links between Merton and Henry Nowell and Gandhi was their common touch. And that in a very academic theological grouping, it's perhaps easy to look apart from the Oprahs and the Bill Gates and that airplane guy with the Virginia lines. That fairies and the fairies are not maybe the political parties, but the rock stars that went out to raise money for Africa. Maybe you know the Gates Foundation trying to get education to American kids when they're doing reports in Time magazine saying they don't have basic grade 9 and 10 coming out of grade 12. And so perhaps the hopes of change are amongst us now, that you think local, act, or think global, act local. And I'm kind of inspired, just want to thank the comments on that vision of art, because we have to see things differently. And maybe the common voices today are the Oprahs, who maybe don't mainstay cut much, swath in academic religious communities, but are touching millions of people in a common way, that there is good and that the world could be a better place. And what our journey is in this word I can't say that you're using all the time. And that dynamic living spirit of just do be present here today in the moment and have faith and trust God that it will have an impact and a change forward. So thank you for your talk.
Was there a comment there? And then I think Henriette, and then you, sir.
Yeah, I want to make a few links, because you said something earlier that made me think that we need not to be motivated out of fear, and because fear is, in that way, our accuser, too. And somehow I want to bring back to what Bruce was saying about addressing our own shadow is part of the way that we dispel our own fear. So when we address our own shadow, recognize that we are capable of everything that everyone else does. You know, basically, it's all about we are one, right? The vision, all that is, we're working towards seeing all humanity, all organisms, all living beings on this planet as one. And it's, when we do that, there's no war possible, of course. So when, on our way of to doing that, we need to address our fears, address our own shadow, and become more whole here within. I think even a garden grown out of fear cannot be, a positive thing. But when we grow a garden, we grow it at all levels of our being. And I think that's where we make the difference.
Is there Henriette, Helen, and then yes.
I know. I know you're
not Henry and Helen. I know you're two
separate. But I didn't
have
my
Henry. Oh, you
did. I honestly tried to.
She just wanted to hear
chef,
something from you.
No,
I'm just bursting at the seams.
Is it going to be a long car ride home?
No.
I can't keep up with Helen.
In fact, I'm thinking of your tongue-in-cheek comment, David, where you said to lady on my left something about just don't ask for a grant. You were talking about women's affairs. And this gentleman back here was talking about the politics, the personal to the political. Okay, so I'm thinking very practically. This discussion is very theoretical for me. So I'm thinking very practically, and I'm thinking about the gentleman in Bangladesh who was just given the Nobel Peace Prize for economics. Get this, are you listening, David?
I know.
For the purpose of microcrediting women in Bangladesh, and he has raised the poverty level for women, therefore children, how many percentage? 97% of women. This is something that he learned from the personal, from going to a little tiny village and talking with the women, okay? And what is the single most significant influencing factor on the wealth of nations? I'll tell you, it is the education of the girl children. The single most influencing factor on the wealth of nations is the education level of the girl children. The girl children. Couple that with one of the Massey lectures, the recent one by Stephen Lewis, Race Against Time. This is much more practical for my purposes.
If you want to set an opinion on the RAWA.org, it's a women's organization in Afghanistan who are saying the Taliban are nice compared to the warlords that are now controlling the north, where there's peace. You know, that where all the troops are hanging out because they don't want to get hurt? Mm-hmm. They're saying the Taliban are nice compared to those guys.
Compared to?
Compared to.
Mm-hmm. Let the women ask for their grants, David.
I'm falling. I was just making reference to, you know.
You know who. Well said.
Sir.
I was just thinking about Ron's comment about politics, and it's a very good one. And it's very frustrating to think about it. It seems an impenetrable system. Politics itself does. It seems as if whatever good intentions people carry with them when they go into politics. I remember years ago knowing an academic in Saskatchewan, his name was Norman Ward, and he always used to speak of the goodness of politics, of the essential possibilities for goodness in politics. But we seem to have reached a point where it's difficult to see that. But following what was just said, there are other creative outlets, surely. I was thinking, just sitting here, how my neck is getting sore, having to turn around to see who's speaking. But we could have these chairs in a more circular pattern and see each other, and the whole communal atmosphere, which we're celebrating at the moment, would be better served in a way. Not that you have anything to do with that, but try that simple thing. And if you think of things like ethical funds, which is just an example that came to mind, something that really wouldn't cost people a lot because they do quite well financially. But there's a whole ethical concept that suddenly gets involved in the way people finance their lives. At the point at which we're speaking now, pension plans are nearly always going to mean that people from here on, unless they work for governments, are going to be stock market watchers. They're essentially in a state of anxiety from the time they retire until either they or the market goes under. And so this kind of creativity which the ethical fund initially involved is not, strictly speaking, political. It is social. It's certainly moral. And it's a symbol of the kind of creativity which a community can generate, and sometimes with very few people in the beginning. Mm-hmm. The wisdom of that thing is seen sort of between the political, so to speak. And dissenting.
And it's interesting because those types of things that go counter to, you know, given knowledge, you know, an ethical fund won't be as stable, won't be as much, or lending money, the great thing, the Grameen Bank, there's no collateral necessary. And I heard just a snippet yesterday from an interview CBC did with, I can't remember his name, but in like 95, talking about how, like, the system is set up to keep poor out of it. Like, you need to have collateral to get a loan. Without collateral, you can't get a loan. If you don't have anything, you don't have collateral, you can't get a loan. And and so it goes against everything, but the Grameen Bank has a higher return on loans than any other bank in the world, from what I know. Like, 97% of the loans are paid back. And so I think this sort of acting, like, acting out of love in your community, in whatever way you do, often, although it counters the knowledge, the given knowledge, often ethical funds are at least as stable, and in the long term will be far more stable because they'll still be something to invest in. Mm-hmm. So,
but aren't the micro banks, the loans are secured by the community? It's the group of women. They lend money to one, but they're accountable to all the others in the group. Like, they have to have six or eight of them on their board of directors, or they have, like, putting that language, they meet together as a group to help each other. And that's why the rate of repayment is they're lifting each other up rather than competing and tearing each other down.
Hmm. I'm not familiar with the exact
model. Any other, just last, the comments, we're at, where are we at? About quarter to, so in the next 4 to 5 minutes, we'll wrap up. Any, did you, Henriette?
Yeah,
you did.
Yeah.
I know you did.
I thought I was having so much fun listening. Now, you were talking with Hannah Arendt and the notion that the fixation, fixation on the end result is not what we're needing. Of course, I'll be coming out a lot that our fixation on the end result creates fear, and fear just blocks our creativity, and without our creativity, we can't even operate towards anything of the good. The end result, I think, may also be shifted to from what is it, what is our purpose, what are we living for, and what is our aim? Presbytery here, observed in India. If our aim is to stay alive and survive in the best possible way, or is our aim to live a creative and worthwhile and respectable life, then our aim can't operate with fear. I mean, the aim for living is blocked by fear, because that creativity with which we can live a good life is just, the plug is pulled out of it. So I think that would shift our aim, shift our end result. If our end result is not just staying alive, if our end result is living a good, accountable life, then I think that maybe shift the picture a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm. And there's probably a distinction between an end that you try to manipulate and a vision of the world that you want to live in, and having a really clear vision of where you want to go, I don't think is living out of fear at all. That's working towards, that's crossing river, that's the ferry, you know, like, that's wanting to get somewhere. And so I guess maybe there's a subtle difference between manipulating ends and visioning what we're working towards.
Do you not think
Two more
that
comments? Sorry, please, go ahead.
Do you not think that our path to the future is depicted by, like, right now, the present, how wars and conflicts between religions are held on from our history? And to look forward, we need to kind of, like, take that stance and let the barriers go of going over, like, exploring the world for ourselves at the moment, to step forward and finding our own foundation and finding who truly we are, you know, instead of being depicted by society, religions, you know, those social groups that we hang on to and allow them to put us in their path instead of standing for who we are, you know, really coming and letting go the external factors.
No, and so it's exactly about like knowing who you are, where you stand, and having the roots.
Yeah.
At the you referred to it earlier. I don't know the poster. I don't know what this poster is, but
roots and wings.
The roots and wings. Yeah, and and that, and I think that that's one of the things that we've lost our roots. We're afraid of our roots. We don't want to acknowledge our roots. Outside of this room, it's really hard to talk about Christianity. It's hard to, you know, like, and so knowing where we are in this moment and where this moment came from is, I think, essential to being able to go forward.
One more remark and then we'll...
The word that comes to mind just sitting back and listening is disenchantment. We're disenchanted from ourselves and each other, and I think we've realized that all the faith that we put in science and technology and development has failed, and it hasn't given us the answers to the questions that really mean who we are, what are we doing, what's our goal in life, what's our path. Science and technology hasn't been able to answer these ultimate questions for us. So humans have looked other places for these answers, and I think through groups like this and discussions, people are finally getting reacquainted with what essential is. What you're talking about, one of the main points is conversation, the lack of conversation. If I went out in Camrose or Edmonton, and like you were saying in India, if I went out and I asked someone, who are you? What do you mean? There's no, people would look at you like you're psychotic or you have a mental problem. But, and I think that's one of the biggest problems is we're disenchanted from each other, and everyone always is looking out for themselves rather than looking out for what they could gain from another or what they could learn from someone else. And I think that's huge.
Yeah.
Is there one more?
No, we'll just leave it.
We'll wrap it.
Can I say something? Can John Ralston, so I'll say a quick goodbye? Yeah, I think so. I think it would work. John Ralston Stoll is a great example of someone who does bridge these worlds into the political and all of that. And in fact, I saw him a year and a half, 2 years ago when he was here. And afterwards, I was like, I need to, you know, it was from that, I think, that I've been thinking about going back to school and like re-engaging in some of this stuff. And he definitely had an impact in that. So he says, to believe in the possibility of change is something very precise. It means that we believe in the reality of choice, that there are choices, that we have the power to choose in the hope of altering society for the greater good. The conviction that citizens have such power lies at the heart of the idea of civilization as a shared project. And the more people are confident that there are real choices, the more they want to vote, a minimal act, and of greater importance, the more they want to become involved in our society.